in some of this matter that he lists here, by actually drawing on the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, and pointing out that when Lazarus was in Abraham's bosom, and the rich man was Hades, yes. And there was a great gulf fixed between them. Brother Thomas takes that and he says, well, that place where the rich man was is the lake of fire, and the lake of fire is Europe, and Abraham's bosom is the land of Palestine, therefore the Mediterranean is the great gulf which is fixed between them. And so he, in that sense, makes the dragon territory Europe, Abraham's bosom Palestine, and the great gulf the Mediterranean Sea. I have only come across that recently, at least it's only registered on my sensorium, as the doctor would say, recently, and I find that a bit hard to, was it too great a camel for my power of deglutition, as the doctor says in Elpis Israel, a bit hard to swallow, but, you know, I think drawing on the rich man and Lazarus to prove that is a little bit hard to take. But anyway, that's the point. He says, yes, the dragon territory is Europe, and you know, the Mediterranean is the border of it. We'll come to that actually in a moment. One or two other comments from this section before we go on to the next section dealing with the resurrection, and which will in effect cover now the first three or four verses here. Over on page 664, come down about 10 lines approximately, he says, starting over on the right hand side, the last word in about the 10th line, this mere human power is to remain in the national abyss without dominion. Sin's flesh is to be turned out of office and to exist only in absolute subjection to spirit as manifested in Jesus and his brethren, all the glorified sons of the deity, ruling the habitable in righteousness for 1,000 years. To keep sin's flesh so long accustomed to rule and revel in its own lusts and superstitions in subjection will require a government strong as iron. The necessity is provided for it is written, he shall rule the nations with an iron rod, so that no deceivers will be permitted to ply mankind with their sorceries, causing them to err from the way of truth and righteousness. The clerical sorceries of the great harlot and her daughters will all be destroyed with the false prophet by the judgments of the fiery lake. So you see, the false prophet and the beast are destroyed in the fiery lake, but flesh itself, represented by the dragon, is permitted to continue on. Now possibly the most important section here, which summarises all of this, is found at the bottom of page 664 and the top of page 665. If you come up exactly six lines from the bottom of page 664, we've got this summary, which I hope will now be meaningful. It's like all the doctor's summaries, that they're very condensed and you've got to read them slowly. But when Daniel's fourth beast shall have been slain, and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame, and the other three beasts have their dominion taken away, so he's quoting Daniel 7 there, the descending angel, he's now back in Revelation, the descending angel will have bound the dragon, the vocation of the false prophets will be abolished, there will be no hypocrites to keep the people in ignorance for the support of the church and state. Now look what he said there, I'll stop at that point. The dragon is chained, the vocation of the false prophets will be abolished, in other words, that's Revelation 19 verse 20, the false prophet is cast into the lake of fire. And the next point is, after the semicolon, there will be no hypocrites to keep the people in ignorance for the support of church and state. And the church and state aspect is the beast, which will also be thrown into the lake of fire. And to subserve the interests of political adventurers and political factions, all this soul and truth destroying machinery will have been broken up, and the nation shall be deceived by it no more for 1,000 years. So it is in that sense then that the dragon can be permitted to continue for 1,000 years, but the beast and the false prophet cast into the lake of fire. We're dealing with this whole section of Revelation 20 which goes down to about verse 4, really. We're looking at this in a lump sum. So the doctor then would continue in the early part of that next paragraph, but after the 1,000 years have passed, the restraint represented by the great chain in the angel's hand will be relaxed. A generation of flesh and blood will then be living, whose men and women will have been born in times of peace and great prosperity. And he goes on to point out that they will have known nothing else than the fact of Christ's rule on earth, and flesh being what it is, will simply take it for granted. We can of course draw the analogy today that we are living in circumstances about the best that flesh has ever had during the premillennial period, and of course those who've known nothing else simply take it for granted. Therefore it is very easy just to manifest our plain fleshly characteristics while thinking we are actually part of the ecclesia, but we may be no more part of the ecclesia than what the dragon system is part of the system of the millennium. They just happen to be there because they were born there, but they take it for granted. A very sobering lesson, because flesh is no different, whether it's the dragon flesh of the kingdom age or whether it's the old man who could be possibly inside of each one of us, although constitutionally we call ourselves the ecclesia. I feel that, you know, we've got to learn these lessons. That's what the apocalypse is all about. It's not just trying to tell us how the kingdom's going to be established. It's warning us to learn from the lessons of the past and the lessons of the future. He says a little later on that some ambitious men will think the season favourable to recover the lost independence of sin's flesh, styled here the devil. They will conspire against the best government the sun ever shone upon, for they are styled Satan, which signifies adversary. They commence to agitate and plot in the national abyss, and at length their secret society, emboldened by numbers, constantly increasing, proceeds more openly to preach revolt. And so this is why we come then to the revolt at the end of the millennium, which is spoken of in verses 3 and 4. I haven't said very much about the dragon being styled the old serpent, the devil and Satan. We did look at that fairly well, I think, back in Revelation chapter 12. And I think that we can assume that most people know what devil means and Satan means, and how it comes to be the old serpent, symbols which take us right back, in fact, to Genesis, don't they? Certainly the serpent one does. But here we are, flesh then, having the restraints removed at the end of the 1,000 years, and now prepared to make an attack on the holy city. Over on page 666, that's hard to say, at the top of the page, their aim is to possess themselves of Jerusalem, the city that had been beloved but now hated, to capture the joy of the whole earth, and to dethrone the government, and to destroy or imprison the saints in the abyss, as they had served the dragon power 1,000 years before, would be the crowning success of the rebellion. Coming down to the bottom of that paragraph, about 6 lines from the bottom of that paragraph, but like the beast and the false prophet then, the ground they occupy becomes the arena of a fiery destruction, and although the locality and the time of their judgment are not the same, yet in coming to their end similarly, the post-millennial devil and Satan combination of nations is said to be cast into the lake of fire and brimstone by fiery judgment descending from the deity out of the heaven and devouring them. So that over in verse 10 of Revelation 20, the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire. So the dragon himself is eventually cast into the lake of fire, like the beast and the false prophet were. The beast and the false prophet were cast into there before the millennium began, the dragon at the end of the millennium. Here are a few tape recorders clicking, so if we want to change over. Yes. The question is, I said that the comments were based on verses 3 and 4, would they not be verses 7 and 8? Yes, that's true. What I was actually looking at was that when we came to verse 5, we then got onto the subject of the resurrection, and I was distinguishing between the subject of the resurrection theme and this one of the dragon. So what happens is it stops at verse 4, then we get onto the resurrection theme, and then we come back to it again in verses 7 and 8. So the complete answer is the section we're dealing with is verses 1 to 4 and also verses 7 and 8. And now, in later reading, also verses 9 and 10 and virtually through to the end of the chapter. But I was separating out the resurrection theme, which I wanted to deal with separately. All right, we'll push on, shall we? We will come back a little bit more to the matter of Gog and Magog in a minute, and the matter of the territory. But we want to have a look now at what is a tricky verse on the surface. It's not really tricky, but in the Authorised Version it is, and it's one of these verses that often gets thrown up in a question session, or it gets asked as a personal question. And that is verse 5. It's having said in verse 4 that the saints lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years, verse 5 says, "But the rest of the dead lived not again until the 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is he that hath part in the first resurrection. On such the second death hath no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. Now there's all sorts of complicating factors can come out of the way that this is written here. In one sense it appears to say that the first resurrection is at the end of the millennium, and then it certainly seems to go on and say that those who partake of the first resurrection will never die again, and from that you can deduce the doctrine that only the righteous will therefore be raised as part of the first resurrection, and therefore the unrighteous are not resurrected for judgment. And I guess once you've established those two, you can then build all sorts of other doctrines out of that in conjunction with the no revolt at the end of the millennium and Gog and Magog, Ezekiel 38. You can imagine what sort of a mess people could make of Revelation 20 if they wanted to. And unfortunately, some do. If that's the problem, what's the answer? Well, Brother Thomas deals with it beautifully, really. We're not going to be able to go through all of what he says from page 667 right through to 673, but he starts off on page 667 and 668 by pointing out to us the sort of quotations that we would use in a public lecture to prove that there will be, quote, a resurrection of the just and of the unjust. You know, the sort of quotes that we take from places like Daniel chapter 12 and other places. So the scripture, apart from Revelation 20, is very clear on the point that there is to be a resurrection of both justified and unjustified. That there are some who come forth unto everlasting life, and some come forth to shame and everlasting contempt. Daniel tells us that. Now, if that's the case, how do we reconcile it with this one here, which tells us that those who partake of the first resurrection will not die again? How does that allow for the fact that other passages tell us that some who partake of the resurrection at the beginning of the millennium will die again? Well, he says, I'd like to read actually the bottom of page 668 because it's very exhortational here. It's the beginning of the answer, but it's not the complete answer, but I think it's worth reading. I've got it marked very heavily here as being an important paragraph. Bottom of page 668, the paragraph that starts, But some of the resurrection come forth to an evil thing which they have not in possession when they come forth. This evil thing which is before them is termed by the judge a resurrection of condemnation. You may be wondering what he's meaning by something, by this evil thing. That's his translation of a passage which he's referred to in the previous paragraph when he says that they have come, two classes come forth. Those who have come forth have done the good things, and they who have committed the evil things. So they come forth unto, he says, something good or something evil. Evil being the consequence of sin. So that's where he gets his word evil from. So the evil thing then which is before them is a resurrection to condemnation. He says the resurrected evildoers do not attain to this resurrection of condemnation until they have been heard. They are allowed to state their own cases and to make the best of them. Some will tell the judge that he is a hard man, reaping where he hath not sown and gathering where he has not strawed. In other words, that he exacted more from his servants than he had a right to, and that if they returned to him just what they had received from him, he ought to be satisfied and account them honest and good. Others will claim admission into the life, glory and kingdom of the Aeon because they have acknowledged him as Lord and prophesied or preached in his name and even done many wonderful works in it. But in that day he will declare to them and to all such that he never acknowledged them and will command them, saying, Depart from me, ye that work iniquity. Here is a certain end to which they came forth from the graves, and it is this end to which they attain that characterizes their coming forth as a resurrection of condemnation. Hence it will be perceived that the aggregate coming forth of this mixed multitude is not the, quote, first resurrection. For all the subjects of the first resurrection are blessed and holy, and cannot be funeralized, that's a good word, cannot be funeralized by the second death. Upon these the second death hath no power, but they shall be priests of the deity and of the Christ, and they shall reign with him 1,000 years. He that overcometh shall not be hurt of the second death. All such living ones, believing the doctrine of Christ, shall not die in the aeon. So he's linked together two passages from Revelation and one from John. Now that he says, it will be seen, therefore, that this mixed multitude comes forth at the same hour for two separate and distinct ends or destinies. The one sought to die again and to reap of the flesh corruption before the aeon of 1,000 years begins. The other sought to be clothed upon with their house from heaven when all the mortal in their grave-developed nature will be swallowed up of life, and to live in the aeon and beyond, possessing the kingdom of the aeon with eternal glory. Hence this mixed multitude is separated into two resurrections, for a short time contemporary the one with the other. The one resurrection consists of all the just who have emerged from the graves, the other resurrection of all the unjust who have come forth. The just and unjust are all mixed up together in their coming forth, hence the necessity of some arrangement whereby the two classes may be respectively separated the one from the other. And he goes on to point out the way in which this will be done. But skipping over several pages now and coming to page 672, he says in the second paragraph down there, perceiving then that the first resurrection does not consist of the indiscriminate mingled people who come forth from the graves in the hour of judgment, we proceed now to attend to what John declares the first resurrection is. He says, I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded on account of the testimony of Jesus and on account of the word of the deity, and who had not worshipped the beast nor his image, and had not received the sign upon their forehead and upon their hand, and they lived. This is the first resurrection. And here's the answer we've been waiting for. That is, the first resurrection consists of those who come forth to a resurrection of life, of the 144,000 redeemed from the earth, having the Lamb's Father's name written in their foreheads, of the redeemed from among men, the first fruits unto the deity and to the Lamb, in whose mouth is found no guile, and who are without fault before the throne of the deity. They are a first resurrection, you see, in the sense that they are a resurrection of first fruits. Coming down about 5 or 6 lines, leaving all out about the nonconformists and so forth, he said, these all being the first fruits unto the deity are apocalyptically styled the first resurrection. It is not so styled in relation to a second or third resurrection, but because it is, and here it is in capitals, the most emphatic typeface that the doctor uses, italics is emphasis, but capitals is superemphasis. He says, because it is the resurrection of the first fruits. Christ is the first fruits, afterwards they that are Christ at his coming, or in his presence, and are planted in the likeness of his resurrection. They are first fruits also, and not only live as death and the grave live before they are cast into the lake of fire, but their names having been written in the book of the life of the aeon from the foundation of the world, they reign with Christ 1,000 years. Therefore, blessed and holy is he that hath part in the first fruits resurrection. On such, the second death hath no power, but they shall be priests of the deity and of the Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. Well, if you like me to put it in simple words, it's simply this, that the word first does not mean first in respect of time, but first in respect of status. So that the just and the unjust come forward at the same time, but they come forth unto a different status. One comes forth unto a resurrection of life, the other unto a resurrection of condemnation. The resurrection of life is the resurrection of those who are the first fruits. Hence it is a first resurrection. As the doctor says, not first in the sense that there will be a second and a third one coming, but the just and the unjust come forward together at the same resurrection, some unto a first resurrection, some unto a resurrection of condemnation. And therefore the first is in the sense of first fruits, being the first fruits to the deity. So the word first is sometimes used in the scripture, not necessarily in relation to time, but in relationship to status. Just escape me for the moment. There's another illustration of where the word is used. The word first is used. Does anyone? I had a feeling it was in Ephesians, but the word is used in this place, in this sense, in other places. Not first in respect of time, but first in respect of status. Anyway, the exposition stands on its own two feet, regardless of my illustration, which I'm unable to bring to mind. But I'm sure there is another one, because I know in expounding the other one I usually use Revelation 20 to prove it. So now I'm going the other way to use that one to prove Revelation 20. Colossians. What, the firstborn, is it? Firstborn from among the dead, is that the one? Firstborn. That would be a similar one. I don't think that's the one I had in mind, but the firstborn was not necessarily the person who was born first, but they achieved a status of chiefborn, and in fact it is so translated that way, chiefborn. First in the sense of chief. Yes, that would be an illustration of it. Maybe that was the one I had in mind, because Ephesians has got something similar. Anyway, the word first then can be chief, not just first in respect of time. I'm saying the same thing over and over again, but that's what we've got there. Now, does that make sense, therefore? You've got to, I think, somehow or other write this down somewhere, because if you come back to it in a week's time and try to explain it to somebody, your argument doesn't sound nearly as convincing, because it is a little bit of a tricky one to see. Verse 18 of Colossians 1, what does that say? That's about the firstborn, is it? That would have been the one, I would think. I don't think that was the illustration I had in mind, but it serves the same purpose, in the sense of it being first in respect of status, a chiefborn. Can't find Colossians at the moment. Colossians 1:18, yes, that's the verse. Sorry, I don't know what I'm thinking about, really. I just can't remember. But I'm sure there's a... We'll look up a concordance, the word first, and it's a similar one to that one. So, look, you can do the exercise and just see if you can find some other examples of where this occurs. But the firstborn one is an illustration of that. Yes. Yes, the first commandment. And that's probably Ephesians 6. Deals with that too, about the first commandment with promise, and that might have been where my connection with Ephesians was. Yes, this idea of first, in other words, if we can just simply get the idea of first in respect of status, not in respect of time, we've got no problem. The trouble is, it's talking about times, it's talking about 1,000 years, certain things happening. You read the first resurrection and you automatically think it means the first one in respect of time, and it doesn't. It means those who come forth unto a chief resurrection, a resurrection of life. And those who don't come forth to that come forth to something less, which is a resurrection of condemnation. Romans 8:29, yeah. Yes, well, this is the term firstborn again. That would be similar to Colossians 1. We also get it in Hebrews, the ecclesia of firstborns, except it's plural there. Yeah, that's a quote. Well, look, thank you very much for all your help to try and help me find that quote. I don't know, but I think we'll have to leave it at that and feel reasonably satisfied that the doctor has given us an excellent exposition. In fact, it may be that in those pages there he's got that very quote that I had in mind. I'll have a look later on. Could even be there. But we want to come on to the latter part. He deals with the rest of the dead and the great white throne. What's happened to our Gog and Magog? We've skipped that somewhere. I thought it was still coming. I want to have a look at his comments in regard to Gog and Magog, and we'll have to go back to do that. Now, this is in respect to verse 8. So we've been handling this thematically rather than in a methodical verse-by-verse fashion, but let's just see the picture. Verses 1 and 2 speak about the angel descending and chaining up the old Satan, the devil, the serpent, the dragon. Verse 3 puts him into the abyss, divests him of his political power, casts him into the nations. The throne of judgment sits, and the ones who've got the Father's name in their foreheads that we've looked at in Revelation 7 and Revelation 14, they're living and reigning with Christ 1,000 years, but the rest of the dead live not until the end of the 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection. You can see what's... Oh, that was the comment I was going to make on verse 5. That early part of verse 5 is sort of in brackets. You know, it goes on from verse 4. They lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. This is the first resurrection. But the rest of the dead, they didn't live till 1,000 years were finished. So that also makes it a little bit complex in the sense of the time. So the first resurrection, the chief resurrection, is speaking of those who lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years, and also those who live again at the end of the millennium. They will also be a first resurrection, because it's in a sense of status. So having then spoken about the resurrection, it then brings us to the end of the millennium, at the end of which time the dragon is loosed. And he goes out, verse 8, to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle. Now, I feel that we've oversimplified that a little bit in the past by simply saying, well, they will manifest the same characteristics as Gog and Magog of Ezekiel chapter 38. Others have said they are the same. Well, the answer is really much simpler than both of those. The first one is an oversimplification. The second one is wrong. The correct answer is that there is a very definite parallel between Gog and Magog of Ezekiel 38 and that of Revelation 20. And I think we'll find that back on page 665, I think, is the... I'm sure I had it marked here. The very bottom of 665 has got a reference to it, yes. Then we'll take it up from there and we'll be... that will give us what we're looking for. All right, page 665. Looking for the one where he quotes Luke chapter 16 about the about the rich man and Lazarus. Well, let's read what he says at the bottom of page 665 anyway. Take it up from about, or just over halfway down page 665. It starts with multitudes. Multitudes will be deceived with false hopes of glory, honour and power in the proposed new dominion of the devil and Satan. Sin's flesh under the rule of the saints is ineligible for office. Under their iron rod and chain, men and women are only permitted to serve. This is a yoke too galling to the pride of human nature, and hence a determination to destroy the existing government, not doubting the enterprise might easily succeed. Their emissaries go forth among the nations of the old dragon territory, which before the dragon was bound, and in the time of his binding, was occupied by Gog of the land of Magog, Rosh, prince of Meshech and Tubal, and therefore styled the Gog and the Magog. These agents of insurrection will be marvellously successful in deceiving the Gog and Magog nations. They call them to arms, and in response, they forsake the plough, seize their weapons, and gather together for war. The rebellion is widespread, and the insurgents numerous as the sand of the sea. Their numbers make them bold and confident. Their commander-in-chief and his council of war, whoever they may be, do not wait to be attacked, but assume the offensive and order the invasion of the Holy Land, which is the camp of the saints. So the first point he makes out to us here is that Gog and Magog have a very definite relationship, inasmuch as they cover the territory of the dragon. So that when Gog comes down and takes Constantinople, he in fact takes over the headquarters of the dragon. And so it will be back in the territory of the dragon that these people will come forth from that part. But the dragon territory will become much more extensive. So that whereas the literal territory of Gog and Magog was Russia and Germany, I don't think we've got to limit it to that, because the characteristics of that territory will be spread throughout the earth, because it goes on to say he'll go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth. So the dragon then will at this stage extend his policy or philosophy to all corners of the earth. So whilst it starts from the dragon territory, the territory of Gog and Magog, it very quickly spreads right throughout the earth, showing that flesh, even though it was under suppression down in South America, was just waiting for somebody to come up with this new philosophy, as the doctor says, whoever it might be and however he might put it forward. And it goes like wildfire throughout the earth. So that whilst we make a big point of saying the Gog of Ezekiel 38 comes out of the north quarters and the Gog of Revelation 20 from the four quarters of the earth, therefore they must be different, yeah, but let's not take our difference too far. There is definitely a relationship too. And the scripture uses Gog and Magog because it was the dragon territory. I still haven't come across that point where he deals with them. Does he deal with the rich man and Lazarus there? Sure, that was. Whilst I don't go along with all of the exposition on it, it's got some interesting conclusions nevertheless. That's last time's. Oh yeah, that's why I couldn't find it. It's prior to chapter 20. Yes, it's back on 660. Thanks, Norm. Yes, if you'd like to go back just for a moment to the section just prior to the commencement of chapter 20 there, on page 660, he's got some very interesting material, and he's talking about the coming forth to judgment. He's dealing now in the context of the false beast, false prophet and the beast. He says in the first paragraph down, "When the wood, hay and stubble as unprofitable servants are cast into outer darkness, they disperse themselves over the countries of the dragon, the beast and the false prophet, which by the judgments coming upon them through the second and third angels are to be kindled into a lake of fire. Thus the fuel of the fiery lake is increased. Now will I rise, saith Yahweh, now will I be exalted, now will I lift up myself. And the people shall be as the burnings of lime, as thorns cut up shall they be burned in the fire, in the European lake of fire. Because of poverty, famine, pestilence, war, and the consciousness of what they have lost by their unfaithfulness, they will find there only weeping and gnashing of teeth. And though they may call upon Abraham to send a Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool their tongues tormented in the flame, were Abraham to reply to them, he would not grant their request, but addressing them as sons would say, remember that in your lifetimes you received your good things, and likewise Lazarus evil things. But now he is comforted, and ye are tormented. And now here is where he extends the parable into the revelation. And beside all this, between us and you there is a great gulf fixed, so that they which would pass from hence to you cannot, neither can they pass to us that would come from thence. Abraham being in the kingdom when this answer is returned shows that the place of torment is not accessible at will, nor territorially continuous with Palestine. In other words, the Mediterranean Gulf separates the Lake of Fire countries from the Kingdom of Israel. It's a very interesting use of Luke 16, which I'm... we always say that Luke 16 is a takeoff of the views of the Pharisees. Well, if that's true, I'd be very loath to now use it as a basis of exposition, but the answer he comes to is obviously correct. Whether Luke 16 can be justifiably used in that sense, I would doubt, but, you know, no man has any right to set up his own ignorance as the limit of, you know, what Helpers Israel page 4 says, and I wouldn't set up my own ignorance against what Brother Thomas can see in this quote, because all too often he's proved to be right. He goes on to say, though, they are the countries invaded by the King of Kings upon the white horse with his hosts of heaven, styled in chapter 14, verse 10, the holy angels and the Lamb. And he goes on to speak about the fiery judgments. He says, such is the locality, over on page 661, and the fuel of the lake of fire, the fire itself that consumes the wood, hay and stubble, or the fearful and unbelieving and the abominable and murderers and whoremongers and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars, is the burning anger of Yahweh's name, as it appears in Isaiah 31, verse 27. So he then points out that this lake of fire is the territory of Europe, and the great gulf which is fixed, or the territory of the beast in Europe, the territory of the dragon in Europe, and that this great gulf is the Mediterranean, which separates the Holy Land from Europe. Well, we must now tidy this up and bring it to a conclusion. So I think we best do that by going simply straight back to Revelation 20. You can read at your leisure the remaining material in Revelation chapter in Eureka. So what we've got then is the policy going out to all the four quarters of the earth. In verse 9, they went up upon the breadth of the earth and compassed the camp of the saints about, and the beloved city, and fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. So divine judgment destroyed them. And the devil, now the devil is the name of the dragon of verse 2. So the beast and the false prophet having been slain previously, the dragon is now cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and false prophet are, and shall be tormented day and night forever and ever. As Brother Roberts points out, Brother Thomas points out, it's not eternal torments, but it is the torment of the aeon of the aeons. It is the punishment which will itself be eternal, but it is also the punishment of the millennial age. And so they will likewise be destroyed. He concludes then by saying, and I saw a great white throne, and him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God. The books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life, and the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books, according to their works. And the sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and hell delivered up the dead which were in them, and they were judged every man according to their works, and death and hell were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. I think most of that is fairly self-explanatory. We're speaking now about the conclusion of the judgments of God. There are one or two terms here about sea and lakes and that which will come out in chapter 21 and 22. But suffice it to say that as far as we're concerned this evening, we've been looking then at the situation of the judgments at the end of the millennium principally. So the beast and the false prophet were judged before the millennium commenced. The dragon is judged at the end of the millennium, the reason being that the beast and the false prophet represent an apostate religious state church system which cannot be permitted to continue, whereas the dragon, more particularly, simply represents flesh as manifested in nations, nations which will be suppressed, and at the end of the millennium will be given their opportunity to show what their real attitude is. Nevertheless, there is a positive side to this, and that is that during the millennium, as this section of Revelation doesn't point out, there will be many who will accept the righteous rule of the Lord Jesus Christ. And it is in that particular respect that we can, in anticipation, look forward to our work in the kingdom as kings and priests. that will be the privilege of the saints in the kingdom to administer the word, to get a far greater response than what we are getting at this time, but at least be cognizant of the fact that although many will heed, flesh itself will not change, and that sacrifice is still the order of the day. It was sacrifice in the case of the Lord Jesus Christ personally. It is sacrifice as far as we are concerned today, and sacrifice will be the great culminating issue at the end of the millennium, when finally flesh itself is destroyed and God will be all in all.
We now bring the meeting to a close, brothers and sisters, by singing together of hymn 145. Hymn 145.